movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Butch Cassidy, The Lost Years by William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Tim Getman and Eric Messner. With performances by Stephen Carpenter, Michael Glenn, David Harris, James Konacek, Michael John Casey, Evan Casey, Joe Brack, Terrence Aselford, Patrick Bussink, Tim Pabone, David Jordan, Scott McCormick, Nanette Savard, Bradley Smith, Tim Carlin, Christopher Graybill, Gabriella Fernandez-Coffey, Tim Lynch, and Barbara Pinolini.
Zephyr, Texas, 1950. After the hot, bright sunlight outside, the grocery store was dim and pleasantly cool. Electric fans sitting here and there in open spaces on the shelves stirred the air around and blended the smells of pepper, vinegar, cinnamon, coffee, and a thousand other items into an aroma that intrigued my senses. In the middle of a hot afternoon like this, the store wasn't busy. In fact, I was the only potential customer at the moment. The sound of ivory against wood drew me toward the rear of the store. A bluish-gray haze of cigarette smoke hung in the air above the scarred wooden table back there, past the meat case and the counter where the cash register squatted. Four men sat at the table playing dominoes. One of them, a stout man wearing a white apron, was probably the store's owner. Another wore jeans and a grease-stained mechanic shirt with the name Howard stitched onto an oval patch sewn to it. The overalls and dirt-encrusted work shoes of the third man indicated that he was a farmer. The fourth man was lean, almost to the point of gauntness, his leathery face a study in planes and angles. He wore a straw cowboy hat tipped back on his head, revealing crisp white hair. His faded blue shirt had snaps on it instead of buttons. He sat with his back to the wall, facing the door, I noted, so he would be able to see anyone who came in. The man glanced up at me, and even though he had to be at least 80 years old, his eyes were those of a younger man, blue and piercing and intelligent. He had a small scar under the left one. The old man looked down at the dominoes in front of him again, obviously dismissing me from his thoughts. That came as no surprise. Tall, slender, and bespectacled, with a natural awkwardness, I knew I wasn't a very impressive physical specimen. I liked to think I made up for that with my mind, but the jury was still out on that. The storekeeper looked up at me, too.
"Something I can do for you, son?"
"I'm looking for Mr. Henry Parker." The glances the other three players shot toward the man in the cowboy hat told me I had come to the right place. The storekeeper nodded toward the old cowboy.
"This here's Hank."
The man added a domino to the arrangement on the table.
"Makes 15.
A rectangular piece of board with holes drilled in it lay on the table near his left hand. The holes were arranged in 5 columns with 10 holes in each column. The cowboy took a small wooden peg and moved it up 3 holes. He didn't look at me. "Hello, Mr. Parker. I was wondering if I could have a word with you."
"Go ahead."
"In private, if we could."
"That sounds like you might be in trouble with the government, Hank. This boy looks like he might be a government man."
"You come from Washington, son?"
"No, sir. Dallas."
"Well, we are right in the middle of a game here. I'm ahead, and I only need 30 more points to go out."
"Lousy domino as I'm getting today, it might take me 3 hands to score that much count."
"Jim Strickland told me to look you up, Mr. Parker."
"Jim Strickland, eh? How is old Jim?"
"Very interesting."
"Don't think I know a Jim Strickland. He in a relation to the Stricklands up at Blanket? I recollect one named Mose, and another boy called Alvey, something like that."
"Jim's no relation, as far as I know."
Parker turned his dominoes face down.
"You fellas go on without me."
"You quitting in the middle of a game? Well, that ain't like you, Hank."
"Well, hell. There'll always be another game, won't there? We'll go sit on one of the benches on the front porch and talk. Now, you gotta buy me a cold soda pop, though. It's hot out there today."
"Sure. How much?"
"Soda pop's a nickel."
I reached into my pocket and handed him a dime. "I'll get one for myself, too." I went to the red metal drink box, paused with my hand on the lid, and looked back at Parker. What would you like, sir?
Coca-Cola will be fine, son.
Parker stepped around the table and the other players. I took two bottles of Coca-Cola from the bed of half-melted ice on the bottom of the box, let them drip for a few seconds, and then popped the caps on the opener attached to the side of the box. I handed one to Parker, and the two of us strolled outside together. It was warmer out here, but at least the awning over the sidewalk put the wooden benches in the shade. The single block of businesses that constituted the community's downtown was all but deserted. No cars hummed past on the highway. The two of us sat down. Parker stretched his legs out in front of him and crossed them at the ankles. His plain brown boots showed signs of long wear. My name is Nathan Tuttle, sir.
Am I going to be pleased to meet you, Nathan? Or am I going to regret it?
I suppose that depends on our conversation.
Ain't that always the way? What brings you to Zephyr, besides a hankering to act all mysterious-like, Nathan?
I work for the Pinkerton Detective Agency.
Go on.
My father was a Pinkerton agent, so was his father before him.
That's not a job that's usually handed down from father to son, from what I hear.
That's the way it worked in my family. My father and grandfather were both devoted to the idea of upholding the law.
Most fellas that feel like that become cops. Not strike breakers and railroad goons.
That's not all the Pinkertons do. They pursue criminals all over the country.
Is that what you're doing, Nathan? Pursuing a criminal?
As a matter of fact, I am. A couple of years ago, not long after I went to work for the agency, I came into the possession of my grandfather's trunk. Inside it were a lot of his notebooks and papers concerning the cases he worked on. I found them to be fascinating reading, especially the ones about his search for one outlaw in particular. Butch Cassidy.
When was this? When your grandpa was looking for Butch Cassidy?
Around the time of the First World War.
Well, I hate to break it to you, Nathan, but he was wasting his time. Butch Cassidy was killed before that down in South America, one of those countries that's even hotter than Texas. I remember hearing all about it. Seems like it was 1906, maybe. Somewhere around in there.
1908. In Bolivia. At a little town called San Vicente.
See? There you go. You know a lot more about it than I do.
That's where Robert Leroy Parker and Harry Longabaugh, better known under their aliases Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, supposedly were killed in a battle with the Bolivian army.
Well, two men against an army. It don't sound very likely they would have come through that alive.
The Pinkertons have never officially declared them dead.
I don't reckon you have to be declared dead to be dead.
My grandfather, Newton Tuttle, believed that while Longabaugh was indeed killed in Bolivia, Robert Parker survived the shooting, although he was wounded and escaped from the Bolivians. A week after the battle at San Vicente, an American who appeared to be ill, or suffering from a gunshot wound, appeared in a coastal village in Chile and bought passage on a trading ship that took him to Lima, Peru. From there, he was able to secure a berth on a liner bound for Liverpool. He traveled under the name Leroy Michaels.
Now, I can see why you might think I'm related to Butch Cassidy, since my name's Parker, and you say that was his real name, too, even though there are a whole heap of people with that last name. I don't reckon I've ever known anybody with the last name of Michaels, though.
Robert Leroy Parker started calling himself Butch Cassidy after he met a rustler named Mike Cassidy. The connection seems obvious to me.
It's your story, Nathan.
Actually, it's my grandfather's story. He's the one who traced Leroy Michaels to England, where he recuperated from his wound and eventually traveled to France and Spain. Only by then, he was using the name Jameson Lowe. Jim Lowe was another name Butch used as an alias for a while.
Go on.
Eventually, Jameson Lowe sailed to New York and disappeared. There's speculation that Etta Place, Harry Longabaugh's lover, was in New York about the same time, so it stands to reason that Cassidy wanted to see her and break the news of the Sundance Kid's death himself. Jameson Lowe dropped out of sight after his visit to New York. My grandfather actually hadn't been assigned to track down Butch Cassidy and determine once and for all if the outlaw was dead or alive. That was just a tangent off another investigation, but he became so interested in it that he continued to follow up on his own time after his superiors insisted that he drop the matter. He came to believe that Butch Cassidy was living in Texas under the name Jim Strickland and had become a successful rancher.
What made him think that?
I don't really know. There are gaps in my grandfather's documentation of his investigation. I know at one point he planned to travel to Texas to meet this fellow Strickland and see if he was right, but I haven't been able to find any indication that he ever made the trip.
Why do you think I'd know anything about Strickland?
Well, you agreed to talk to me after I mentioned the name, didn't you?
I just wanted to see what sort of burr you had under your saddle, son. I could tell as soon as you came in the store you were fit to bust about something. You've spun an interesting yarn, but what does it have to do with me?
I suppose I've talked around it for long enough, haven't I? I've taken up the challenge where my grandfather left off, sir. I've been trying to find out what happened to Jim Strickland, and I've traced the man I believe was using that name through several more identities until I arrived at a conclusion. I believe that you are the man who was once known as Jim Strickland, Mr. Parker. Or should I say, Mr. Cassidy?
Son, you've been out in the sun too long. It's done something to your brain. Do I really look like a famous owl hoot and train robber to you? I'm just a stove-up old cowboy.
You seem rather spry for your age, sir. Which, if I'm not mistaken, is just about the same age as Butch Cassidy would be if he survived that shootout in Bolivia. Mid-80s, am I right?
Be 85, my next birthday. Just what the hell would you do, kid, if I said, yeah, I'm Butch Cassidy?
In all likelihood, I wouldn't do anything. There are no charges still on the books against Butch Cassidy. I just want to know the truth. I want to know if my grandfather was right.
Well, I'm not admitting anything of the sort, mind you. But folks around here seem to think I'm a pretty good storyteller. Tell you what I'll do. You spun me a yarn. So what say I spin you a yarn of what it might have been like if I really was Butch Cassidy? How about that?
I'm more than willing to listen to anything you want to tell me, sir.
All right, then. If you're right about that wild idea you got in your head, and I ain't saying you are, mind you, then the story you're looking for begins on a cold night in West Texas in 1914. When I saw the Blue Norther coming, I would have found a place to hold up and wait it out. Except there didn't seem to be any such thing in these parts. It was a damn fool stunt to begin with, starting from San Antonio to El Paso on horseback in December. But I'd never spent that much time in Texas, and I wanted to take a gander at some of the country. You hear Texans bragging about the place all the time, as they're in the habit of doing, and after a while, you want to see it for yourself. So I bought a couple of good horses and some supplies, figuring I'd use one of the animals as a pack horse and the other as a saddle mount and switch back and forth between them, and set off across country. That's how I came to be out in the middle of nowhere when the sky turned so blue it was almost black, and the wind began to howl out of the north, bringing with it a bone-numbing chill. I lowered my head, hunkered deeper in my sheepskin coat, and kept going. I knew there had to be a ranch house somewhere ahead of me, and if I kept moving, I'd find it. I knew that because if there wasn't, I stood a good chance of freezing to death before morning. The light was starting to fade when I heard what might be gunshots. It was hard to tell exactly where they came from, too. But I turned my horses in what I hoped was the right direction. Now, you may think it was foolish of me riding toward gunfire rather than away from it, but I looked at it like this. Whoever was shooting that gun probably had a place to get in out of the weather. And that was what I needed more than anything else tonight. The last of the gray light disappeared, and I was left to plod along in darkness. My horse stopped short and shied back a step.
Whoa, easy there, fella.
I couldn't see what had spooked him. I wasn't carrying a handgun, but I had a Winchester and a scabbard strapped to the saddle. I drew it out and worked the lever to throw a cartridge into the chamber. Then I swung a leg over the saddle and slid to the ground. The pack horse's reins were tied to the saddle horn. I hung on to the reins of the animal I'd been riding as I moved forward cautiously. It only took a couple of steps to tell me why my horse had stopped. The ground fell away into a gully. I could barely make it out as it twisted across the plains like a snake. If the gully wasn't too deep and the sides weren't too steep, the horses and I could climb down into it and get out of the wind at least. I might find enough wood to build a small fire.
I put the rifle back in its sheath and hunkered on my heels at the edge of the gully. I reached into my coat and fished a match from my shirt pocket. It lit when I snapped the head with my thumbnail, but the wind snatched the flame right out. Trying to get one burning up here was just going to be a waste of matches. I slid a foot over the edge and used it to explore the slope. It wasn't a sheer drop-off, so I had hopes of being able to get the horses down there. The prairie was dotted with mesquite trees, their limbs skeleton bare at this time of year. I tied the saddle horse's reins to one of them and went back to the edge of the gully. I was going to have to explore it by feel until I got down out of the wind. I turned around so I was facing the slope and started climbing down. The gully wall was rough enough that there were plenty of places to brace myself. When I got down low enough that my head was out of the wind, the night was still plenty cold, but not as breathtakingly raw. My right foot came down on something soft. I'd be lying if I said I didn't jump up in the air. When I came down, I lost my balance and started rolling. I only turned over a couple of times before I hit bottom. Even so, I landed hard enough to knock the wind out of me and send my hat flying.
What in the blue blazes?
I sat up and scuttled backward a little, well aware that I'd left my Winchester up on the flat with the horses.
Who's there?
You have any whiskey, amigo?
Are you hurt, old son?
You can say that. I got a couple of bullet holes in my gut.
Hold on. I'll see what I can do.
I started to crawl toward the sound of his voice, then paused.
Now, you ain't fixing to shoot me, are you?
No reason to. You ain't one of the varmints who shot me. They've long since took off for the tall and uncut.
I found another match and lit it. This time, I was able to keep it going by cupping my hand around the flame, although the wind caused it to dance around quite a bit. The feeble, flickering glow from it revealed a stocky man with a close-cropped white beard lying against the bank like he'd slid part of the way down it. His coat must have hung on something and stopped him. He had both arms crossed over his belly. A glance over my shoulder told me that the gully was about a dozen feet wide, with a sandy, fairly level bottom. Clumps of brush grew here and there.
Let me help you lay down, old-timer, and I'll take a look at those wounds.
Oh! I told you I want whiskey. There ain't nothing you can do about the other.
Oh. I figured he'd be more comfortable stretched out, though, so when the match burned down, I shook it out and got hold of him, lifting him as gently as I could and easing him down, so that his legs were in front of him on the gully floor and his back was leaned against the bank. It took me only a few minutes to find my hat, gather some dry branches from the brush, place them in a heap, and get a fire burning. Once the flames were going, they gave off enough light I could see a broken down place in the bank where I thought I could get the horses down.
I'll be back.
I ain't going nowheres.
I brought the horses down one at a time and tied them to a sturdy looking bush. They were close enough to the fire to draw a little warmth from it. Then I got the flask from my saddlebags and knelt down next to the wounded man. I uncapped the flask and held it to his mouth.
There you go. Who shot you, mister?
Abner.
Somebody named Abner ventilated you.
I know, damn it. That's my name. Abner Tillotson. Don't want to cash out without somebody knowing who I am.
All right, Mr. Tillotson. What happened?
I thought you was going to try to patch me up.
Well, I decided there wouldn't be a whole lot of point to it.
You're right about that. Oh, I tell you what happened. I was shot by three no-account rustlers, that's what.
You got a spread hereabouts?
We're on it. The fish hook.
You have a family there?
Oh, no family anywhere, just me. Three or four Mex hands worked for me part-time. None of them there now. I knew there was a northern coming, so I rode out to check on my critters. That's when I come across them rustlers.
Who the hell'd be out wide-looping cattle in weather like this?
Those no-good Daughtry boys. Stealing
comes as natural as breathing to them. They don't care what the weather's like. They were just pushing a dozen of my cows towards their place. I yelled for them to stop, and they turned around and started burning powder at me. Oh, I could do with another drink.
Oh. Where's your ranch house? I'll get you back there.
2 miles due west of here. It backs up against a butte. You'll find it, but you'll have to come back and get me later. If the coyotes ain't drag me off. You got something else to do tonight?
I wasn't planning on doing anything except trying to keep from freezing to death.
No. You're gonna go after them Daughtrys and settle accounts for me.
Now why the hell would I want to do that?
Because I'm gonna give you my ranch in return for avenging me.
Why?
I've seen 1,000 drifters like you in my time, son. I know what you need. You need a home. You ain't as young as you used to be. You're bound to be getting a mite tired. You need a good place to settle down. And the fish hook's a fine spread. I'll sign it over to you right here and now. If you give me your word, you'll settle those rustlers hash.
You said there was 3 of them? 3 against 1 ain't very good odds.
Yeah, but I can tell by looking at you. You still got the bark on you. You still got the bark on you, boy. I'm betting my ranch you can do it. Of course, I'm losing one way or the other, ain't I?
All right, Mr. Tillotson. I'll do it. I'll go after those rustlers. Can't promise you I'll kill all of them, but I'll do my damnedest.
That's all anybody can ask of a man. You got paper and pencil?
Yeah.
Get it. Write out a bill of sale. I'll sign it. But, oh, give me another drink first.
I did that. Then I took out a book I'd bought in San Antonio.
Oh.
I picked it up because it was a story about a cowboy named Cassidy who had a bum leg, and that struck me as funny. The book had a blank page or two in the back. So I tore one of them out, flattened it on the cover, and after pausing to build up the fire a little and make it brighter, I used a stub of a pencil to scrawl a bill of sale transferring ownership of the Fish Hook Ranch from Abner Tillotson to... Until that moment, I hadn't thought about what name I was going to put down. I'd gone by several different names in my life. Sometimes it came in handy for a man in my line of work to be somebody else. I'd used the name Jim before, and to be honest, I just plucked Strickland out of thin air. I didn't recall ever knowing anybody by that name. So I wrote down Jim Strickland, and then I read what I'd written to Abner. He managed a weak nod.
That'll be fine. You're a good man, Jim. Give me the pencil. Oh, I'm afraid I'm gonna get blood on it.
Don't you worry about that. Abner took the pencil. I held the book where he could sign his name on the page. His hand was shaking some, but I could read his signature. I didn't think anybody would dispute the bill of sale, since he didn't have any family. When he was finished, his hand fell back in his lap.
You better get after him now. They got a shack a couple of miles north of here. Ain't much more than a lean-to built against a little rise. Don't trust them. They're tricky bastards. I never should have given them any warning. Should have just started shooting first myself. You might want to bear that in mind.
I sure will, Abner. You better get some rest now, here.
You think you could see your way clear to leaving that flask with me? While you go after those skunks.
Sure, I can do that. I pressed the silver flask into the hand that had held the pencil. Abner had dropped it on the ground beside him.
Much obliged.
Abner seemed to be having trouble keeping his eyes open now. His head rested against the dirt wall behind him. His chest still rose and fell, but slow. Slow. I didn't really know a blasted thing about Abner Tillotson. But I like to think I'm a pretty good judge of character. And my instincts told me
He didn't deserve to go out like this. I folded the page with Abner's signature on it and stuck it in my hip pocket. Then, I went over to my horse and put the book back in the saddlebags. I'll be back, Abner. Then, without thinking too much about what I was doing, I untied the reins, swung up into the saddle, and rode off into a dark, bone-chilling night in search of a trio of murdering rustlers. I left the pack horse in the gully with Abner. I left the fire burning, too, which went against the grain because of the danger of prairie fires. My hope, though, was that it would keep the scavengers away from him for a while. Maybe I would get back before the fire burned down completely. He had said the Daughtry place was a couple miles north of the gully. It was too dark to be sure how much ground I was covering, but I was counting on spotting a lighted window to steer by. Until then, I had to rely on instinct to keep me going in the right direction. After a while, just when I started to worry that I was lost and wouldn't be able to find my way back to the gully, a faint yellow glow appeared in the distance ahead of me. It was tiny at first, but got bigger as I rode toward it. Eventually, I was able to tell by its roughly rectangular shape that it was the window I'd been looking for. From what Abner had told me, I felt confident that I was approaching the Daughtry place. He hadn't mentioned anybody else living around these parts. With the wind blowing out of the north the way it was, I didn't think they'd hear my horse's hoofbeats. Just to be sure, though, I reined in when we were about 50 yards away. I didn't see anything close by where I could tie the horse, so I let the reins dangle and left him ground hitched. I pulled the Winchester from the scabbard and started toward the light on foot. When I got closer, I could make out more of the details, even on that dark night. The shack looked like a jumble of boards piled against the face of a little bluff. It had a tin and tar paper roof with the iron stovepipe sticking up through it. With a bluff to block the wind and a fire going in the stove, it might be halfway comfortable in there, I thought. Off to the right was a shed that actually looked more sturdily built than the shack. I saw several bulky shapes huddled together in there. I guess the Daughtrys knew how important it was for a man to take care of his horse. Beyond the shed was a corral. The stolen cattle stood stolidly inside it, with their back ends turned toward the wind. It would have been easy enough to kick the door down and go in shooting, but something stopped me. As I mentioned, I've had what you might call a checkered past. But for most of that time, even in my wildest years, I'd managed not to kill anybody. There had come a point where that changed. Sometimes there's just no other way out. And to be honest, there are some evil bastards in the world who just need killing. But I still didn't want to ventilate anybody who didn't have it coming. As I stared at that lighted window, I realized that I didn't know for an absolute certainty it was the Daughtrys in there. Even if it was, I didn't know who else might be in the shack with them. What I needed to do was draw them out some way, and I thought I saw a way to do it. That stovepipe poked up through the tar paper fairly close to the bluff. I circled round and climbed the bluff well away from the shack. Even though I was only about 8 feet higher than I had been, the wind felt even harder and colder up there. I tried to ignore it as I cat-footed toward the shack. When I was behind the haphazard assemblage of lumber, I took off my coat. Under it, I wore a thick flannel shirt and a pair of long underwear, but the wind cut through both garments like they weren't there. Trembling, I hung the jacket on the end of my rifle barrel and extended it toward the stovepipe. It almost reached. I gave the Winchester a flick of my wrist. The jacket jumped in the air and settled over the top of the pipe. I crouched there on the bluff, waiting for something to happen. I didn't have to wait long. The shack's door slammed open. 3 men stumbled out. The Winchester had 15 rounds, so I figured I could spare one. I put it into the ground near their feet, making them jump. They had made the mistake of all standing close together instead of spreading out, which told me they were pure amateurs when it came to being ambushed.
Stand right where you are. I'll kill the first man who moves.
One of them started to reach under his coat. He stopped when I worked the Winchester's lever.
Who in blazes are you?
Never mind about who I am. Is your name Daughtry?
What the hell business is that of yours?
Just answer the question.
I'm Ned Daughtry. and these are my brothers, Cleet and Otto. You satisfied now, you son of a bitch?
Anybody else inside?
No, just the three of us.
In that case, Abner Tillotson says you should all go to hell.
Who's Tillotson to you?
A friend.
That decided it. They knew they'd gunned Abner, and they knew I'd come gunning for them in return. Wasn't nothing left but to get to it. So that's what I did. I already had the Winchester pointed at one of them. So I went ahead and shot him as soon as they started to reach. The slug dropped him to his knees. I worked the lever as I swung the rifle and fired two more rounds as fast as I could crank them off. They returned fire. I went to one knee as a bullet whizzed over my head. A second Daughtry brother stumbled and fell. I tried to locate the third one so I could shoot at him some more, but he was gone. Couldn't see him, but he might be able to see me. I flattened out on top of the bluff. I knew I'd fired 9 times and had 6 rounds left. That ought to be plenty, I thought. But first, I had to have something to shoot at. I couldn't see anything. Couldn't hear anything except the wind. But I knew somewhere out there was a fellow who wanted to kill me. And I didn't like that feeling, not one bit. He was a slick bastard. Got around behind me somehow. If he hadn't stumbled a little in the dark, he might have plugged me. As it was, I rolled over just in time to feel his shot whip past my ear and hit the ground instead of blowing off the back of my head. I got a shot off.
You goddamn varmint! Son of a bitch!
But it must have gone wild because he was on me, kicking me in the side. I dropped the rifle, grabbed his leg, and heaved on it. He fell and landed on top of me. And we both went off the edge of the bluff, dropping 2 feet to crash onto the shack's roof. We broke through it and fell another few feet, landing on a table this time. He was still on top of me. I shoved him off the table onto the floor. I rolled off the table the other way. I put one hand on the table to steady myself as I looked around for a weapon of some sort. Daughtry's pistol blasted again as he rose up on the other side of the table, and it went into the wall behind me. I grabbed the kerosene lantern sitting on the shelf against the wall and flung it. Fire leaped up on his chest and set his beard on fire. He got so worked up about that, jumping around, that he forgot about trying to shoot me again. I leaped onto the table and pushed off of it into a diving tackle until it took him off his feet. Back of his head hit the hard-packed dirt floor. He didn't move after that. Just lay there with the fire consuming his buffalo hide coat, his beard, and his face. Fortunately, the smoke had cleared out some with the door open. I picked up the revolver he dropped, tucked it behind my belt, and grabbed his ankles so I could drag him outside. I hadn't forgotten about the other two brothers, so as soon as I had the burning one out of the shack, I dropped his legs and drew the gun, even though I didn't know whether it still had any bullets in it. Turned out it didn't matter, because neither of the other two Daughtrys were moving, and never would again unless somebody picked them up and carried them. I didn't intend to waste that much effort. From the corner of my eye, I saw some other flames and looked up to see that the heat from the stovepipe had finally set my coat on fire.
Oh, son of a bitch.
That coat was a good one, and without something to break the wind, I might still freeze before morning. I looked around the inside of the shack for something I could wear. I found another buffalo hide coat and shrugged into it. I found a box of cartridges, too, and reloaded the Colt I had picked up. I stood by the stove for a few minutes to warm up as much as I could before venturing out into the night again. When I knew I couldn't postpone it any longer, I climbed up onto the ridge, got my rifle, and then went in search of my horse. He had wandered off, but hadn't gone far with his reins dangling like that.
It's okay, boy. Everything's all right. Everything's fine.
The whole affair had spooked him some. I had to comfort him for a few minutes before he settled down enough for me to catch him. Soon I was riding south again, hoping I could find the gully where I'd left Abner Tillotson and my other horse. At least the wind was at my back during that ride. The fire was still burning by the time I reached the gully. Abner's body was undisturbed. Cold as it could be, too. He'd either been dead when I rode away earlier, or had crossed the divide soon after. The pack horse was still there.
At least I came back for you, old son, instead of getting myself killed, too.
I took one of my extra blankets from the pack and spread it out on the ground. I then laid Abner's body on it and rolled him up. I finally got Abner loaded. I led both horses out of the gully. The wind had actually died down a mite, the norther having expended some of its force. I saw a few stars overhead through gaps in the clouds, and they helped me steer a westward course. By morning, the wind would die down all the way, I knew, and the clouds would break up and clear off, and the temperature would drop like it had fallen in a well. I could have tried to ride it out in the gully, but it would be better if I could find the ranch house. The starlight helped, and so did the good sense of direction I'd been born with. Some hills rose to the north and south, and smack dab in the middle of the valley between them, I found Abner's ranch house. It was an adobe in the Mexican hacienda style, with a good-sized barn, a couple of corrals, a cook shack, a small bunkhouse, a blacksmith shop, and a smokehouse. Of course, I didn't know all that at the time. I could just see some buildings scattered around, but I didn't explore them. I just put the horses in the barn, unloaded Abner's body, and carried it into the house. It was dark as sin inside, so I laid him on the floor until I'd fumbled around, found a lamp, and got it lit. Then, as the yellow glow filled the room, I picked him up again and placed his blanket-wrapped corpse on the bed in the back corner. There was a fireplace on the other side of the room with a supply of wood piled up beside it. I got a good blaze going so the place could warm up while I was tending to the horses. It was still chilly, but reasonably comfortable in there when I came back in from the barn. The adobe had one main room with the fireplace and a table and chairs on one side, an old sofa and a couple of rocking chairs on the other side, and the bed in the back. A bookcase full of books stood against the wall between the rocking chairs. It appeared that Abner was an avid reader, like a lot of men who live alone. The lamp was on a small table beside one of the chairs. It had a green glass base and a ceramic top with roses painted on it. Not exactly the sort of thing you'd expect to find in an isolated ranch house where a rough old cattleman lived alone. I suspected there had been a woman in Abner Tillotson's life at one time or another, and this lamp was a memento of their time together. That was a story I'd likely never know. I'd brought in my supplies, so when the flames in the fireplace died down a little, I boiled some coffee, fried some bacon, and ate it with a couple of leftover biscuits I'd had wrapped up in my saddlebags. It was meager enough fare, but satisfied my hunger. I didn't mind preparing a meal with a corpse on the other side of the room, and I wasn't going to be bothered by sleeping in the same room with him once I stretched out on that sofa. I'd occupied closer quarters with dead men before. I was up early the next morning, and it was as cold as I'd figured it would be. But the wind was still so it didn't feel too bad. It hadn't been cold enough, long enough, to freeze the ground. Once I'd looked around and found a suitable spot for a grave, I didn't have much trouble digging it. The place I picked was on a little rise off to the south that overlooked both the ranch headquarters and the little creek that ran nearby. The view wasn't all that much just then, but I figured it would be pretty nice come summer. There was a buckboard in the barn along with a couple of mules and two horses besides my pair. I hitched the mules to the buckboard, loaded Abner on it, and drove out to the hill where I dug the grave. When I got there, I found a strange horse waiting. The saddle he wore told me it was likely Abner's mount, come home after spending a cold night wandering around.
You're lucky you didn't freeze to death, Oss.
He tossed his head in agreement, then stood there watching solemnly while I lowered Abner into the grave and shoveled dirt back into the hole. When I finished, I took off my hat.
Lord, it's been a while since we talked, but I'm hoping you recollect who I am. This man was named Abner Tillotson. You're probably better acquainted with him than I was, and I didn't really know him, but he struck me as a good sort. He didn't cut down on those rustlers when he could have, and probably should have. So maybe you'll have the same sort of mercy on him and welcome him home up yonder. Yeah, that'll do it, I guess. Amen.
When it warmed up some, I'd make a marker and put it out here on the grave. For now, that was all I could do. I led the horse back to the barn, and after I'd unhitched the mules, I unsaddled him, broke up the ice on the water bucket in the stall where I put him, and dumped some grain in the trough. I went back in the house and started fixing some breakfast. Later that day, I put my saddle on the horse I'd been using as a pack animal and rode back to the Daughtry place. I didn't have any trouble finding it. It didn't look any better in broad daylight. The three bodies lying scattered around in front of the shack didn't help its appearance any, especially since the buzzards and coyotes had already been at them. Abner had said the brothers were hazing off a dozen of his cows when he came upon them. I counted the critters in the corral and came up with 18. Couldn't be sure where the other six came from without examining the brands, but I figured there was a good chance they were fishhook stock too. So I opened the corral gate and drove out the whole bunch. They were mine now. That left the three horses in the shed. There was no telling when somebody else would come along. Might be days or weeks or even months. I opened the gate on the front of the shed and let them out too. I didn't want to be caught with horses that had belonged to three dead men. So I took off my hat, waved it in the air, and yelled at them until they ran off. I drove the cows back to the fishhook. This couldn't be all of Abner's herd, my herd now, but I didn't know yet where he had grazed the others, so I let them stop along the creek. There wasn't much grass there, but enough to keep them from straying, I hoped. With that chore taken care of, I spent the rest of the day exploring the ranch, including all the buildings around the main house. I didn't know the boundaries of the Fishhook Range, but I rode a good distance north, south, east, and west, making a big circle around the place. I had the Winchester with me, plus the Colt revolver I'd taken from the Daughtry brother who kicked me in the side. I found another couple hundred head of stock scattered around the base of the hills to the south. They were branded with a crooked mark I took to represent a fish hook, plus the letters AT. I also found a small herd grazing in a pasture to the east, not far from the gully where I'd run into Abner. The rustled stock had to have come from that bunch. When I got back to the house, I took the cows in the corral and drove them out to join the others. I checked the brands first, though. Sure enough, the extra six animals had fishhook brands on them, although the Daughtrys had tried to rework them into something else. That was a full day's work. After supper that evening, I pulled out an old trunk I found in one of the small back rooms while I was looking for clean bedding and went through its contents. The first thing I found was a sober black suit. It looked like it hadn't been worn for years. It was dusty and smelled of mothballs. Too small for me, even if I'd wanted to wear it, which I didn't, so I set it aside. I found some dish towels with fancy stitching on them, another indication that there had been a woman in Abner's life at one time. Wrapped up in one of the towels was a photograph in an oval gilt frame. It was the sort of picture you saw a lot back in those days, with a man sitting in a chair while a woman stood just behind him and to the side of him with her right hand resting on his left shoulder. The man was a lot younger, and his hair and beard were dark, but I could tell he was Abner. The woman had fair hair that fluffed prettily around her head. Both of them were dressed in their best duds. I turned the photograph over, but nothing was written on the back. I wrapped it up in the dish towel again and set it with a suit, which I had a hunch might be the same one Abner was wearing in the picture. Some more digging around in the trunk turned up a big, thick, heavy book. It was a family Bible, and knowing that people often kept important documents in such a book, I sat cross-legged on the floor, put it in my lap, and carefully opened it. Sure enough, several folded documents were right in the front of the Bible. One of them was the deed to this property. That was what I'd been hoping to find, because it gave the boundaries of the land. The fishhook wasn't big at all as ranches go in Texas, only about 50 square miles, but it had been big enough to suit Abner. I found a marriage license in the Bible too, telling me that Abner James Tillotson had married Martha Grace Hargity in San Marcos, Texas on October 12, 1882. That put a name on the woman standing beside Abner in the photograph. There was some paperwork registering the fishhook brand with the state, some county tax records, and a few receipts that didn't mean anything to me. I'd found what I was looking for. But instead of putting the Bible away, I turned a few more pages and came to the family record. A woman's hand had recorded the dates that Abner and Martha were born and the date of their marriage. In the death section on the next page, in a man's much cruder script, was written Martha Grace Tillotson, died September 18, 1883. and John Abbott Tillotson died September 18th, 1883. I found one other thing of interest in the trunk, a coiled cartridge belt with an attached holster that held a long-barreled Remington revolver. It was a fine-looking gun, and obviously well cared for. I stood up and tried on the belt. It fit well enough, although Abner had been a little thicker through the middle than me, and must have fastened the buckle in a different hole. The gun wasn't loaded, but there were a couple of boxes of cartridges in the trunk. I left them out when I replaced everything else from the trunk and put it away. So I had a place to live, 5 horses, 2 mules, a couple hundred head of stock, a rifle, and 2 pistols. I've held small fortunes in my hands on a number of occasions, but right then, as I walked outside and looked around my ranch, I felt pretty rich. It had been a while since I worked a spread like this, but I remembered what needed to be done. Abner had done a good job of keeping the place up, and that sure helped. By the time spring was about to roll around, I had fixed everything that needed fixing. It had been a pretty mild winter. The cattle came through it pretty well and were in good shape. The nearest town, about 15 miles southeast, was a wide place in the road called Largo. Not much there, but it had a store, and I had hitched the mules to the buckboard and driven in a few times for supplies. The first time I did, the storekeeper, a small man with perpetual beard stubble and a wary merchant's look in his eyes, had looked out the front window for a long moment.
Ain't that Abner Tillotson's buckboard?
It was. I bought it from him, along with everything else on the place.
Did you now?
Well, yes, sir. Lock, stock, and barrel. Jim Strickland's the name.
Glad to meet you. Clyde Farnham's my handle. Hard to believe old Abner would sell out. He's lived on that spread for as far back as I can remember.
He said his health was going south on him. Yeah. Tell you the truth, Mr. Farnham, I don't think he had a lot of time left to him, and he knew it. I figure he wanted to be sure that his place was left in good hands, him having put so much work into it and all.
How'd he come to sell it to you? I don't like being nosy, mind you, but I considered Abner a friend.
Well, so did a lot of people, I reckon. That's how he and I met, through some mutual friends back in San Marcos.
That was a shot in the dark, but I thought since Abner had gotten married in San Marcos, he might still know some folks there.
I used to see a letter for Abner come through here now and then with a San Marcos postmark on it. I'm the local postmaster, you know.
Well, there you go.
Are you going to change the brand?
No, sir, I don't believe I will. I'd be honored to run the same brand that Abner established for all these years.
That's a nice thing to do. What can I get you today?
That was all it took. Farnham was a talkative sort and well-respected thereabouts, so after he accepted me, I was a member of the community as far as other folks were concerned, and I didn't even have to show him the bill of sale Abner had signed, although I was prepared to do so if need be. Except when I went into town, I didn't see many people during those months. There was a road of sorts from the Fish Hook to Largo, and somebody could have driven a car over it, I supposed, but nobody did. One day, an itinerant preacher came by in a buggy and offered to save my soul in exchange for a meal. I gave him the meal, but told him my soul was just fine.
It's good that you're right with the Lord, son. You just never know in this world. You just never know.
I couldn't argue with that. Life was a continual surprise. Sometimes I thought I was the never-knowingest son of a bitch on the face of the earth. Another day, I saw a rider coming over the hills to the north while he was still quite a ways off. I was working outside on the corral fence at the time. The Winchester leaned against the fence, not far from where I was. But I put the hammer down anyway, went into the house, and buckled on that old gun belt of Abner. I went back to work, but kept one eye on the rider. He slowed his horse to a walk as he came up. As far as I could see, he wasn't armed. His horse looked plumb worn out, and so did he. 18 or 20 years old, I thought. The boy, not the horse. Although, I wouldn't have ventured a guess as to its age. He had the gauntness of long, weary trails about him. It was a look I knew well.
Good day to you, sir.
Hello, son. Your horse looks like it could do with some water.
I nodded toward the well. Help yourself.
Thank you, sir. Is it all right if I have some for myself?
Nope.
What? Why?
I've got coffee in the house, and you're welcome to some of that. I've seen a lot colder, but it's still sort of a chilly day.
I'm obliged to you again. I'll tend to my horse first.
That's what I'd expect. Every instinct I had told me somebody was after him. Probably the law. But it was none of my business, and that's the way I wanted to keep it. He watered his horse, and I gave him some coffee and wrapped up some biscuits for him to take along with him when he left. He started to mount up, then paused.
You wouldn't be looking to take on any riders, would you, sir?
No, son. I'm afraid I wouldn't.
Oh. Well, thanks again.
He didn't tell me his name, and I didn't offer mine. He rode on, and I kept an eye on him until he was out of sight. A week or so after that, three more riders approached the ranch, but they came from the south this time. Since they came from the opposite direction, I figured they probably didn't have anything to do with the youngster. As they drew closer, I saw they were Mexicans in well-worn vaquero clothes. I met them out in front of the house with the Remington on my hip and the Winchester in the crook of my left arm. They were all in their 20s. One of them edged his mount slightly ahead of the others. He had a thick black mustache and the face of a hawk, and looked like he should have been riding with Pancho Villa. Howdy.
¿Dónde está Señor Tillotson?
Can you speak English, my friend?
Sí, of course. Where is Señor Tillotson?
He sold the ranch to me a while back. Who are you?
Santiago Marquez. These are my cousins Javier and Fernando. We worked for Señor Tillotson, or I should say we did. We came to see if he was ready for us to start preparing for the spring roundup.
Let me study on that, Señor Marquez. Can you ride back here in, say, a week or so? I'm sorry to inconvenience you.
De nada. A week would be fine, Señor...
Strickland. Jim Strickland.
We will see you in a week, Señor.
Neither of the other two had said a word so far, but before Santiago could turn his horse to ride away, one of them spoke up.
Mira, alguien se acerca.
Santiago pointed to the northeast.
Looks like you have more company coming, Señor. This is a popular place today.
Too popular, as far as I was concerned. I'd come to value my privacy. I squinted into the distance and saw a buggy rolling toward the ranch houses. For a second, I thought the preacher was back, until I realized it was a different vehicle.
Now, who the blazes?
I can tell you that, Señor Strickland. It appears that the sheriff is about to pay you a visit.
Sheriff, eh? Wonder what he wants.
I suspect we will find out, Señor.
Santiago didn't act like he was leaving anymore, and the other vaqueros sat there stolidly on their horses, following their cousin's lead. They wanted to see what was going to happen. I couldn't blame them for being curious. I was wondering about that myself. The sheriff's buggy rolled steadily closer. A fine matched pair of bay horses pulled it. Only one man rode in the seat. He wore a gray pinstripe suit, a black vest, and a white shirt buttoned up to the collar with no tie. A flat crown gray hat set square on his head. Bushy side whiskers came down onto his jaw, flanking a rough-hewn face. Under a prominent nose that reminded me of a potato was a brown mustache. He wasn't what you'd call a handsome man. He brought the buggy to a stop, gave the Mexicans a dismissive glance as if they didn't matter, and nodded to me. He pulled back his lapel a little so the sun reflected off the badge pinned to his vest.
Good day, sir. I'm Sheriff Emil Lester.
Pleased to make your acquaintance, Sheriff. Jim Strickland's my handle.
This is Abner Tillotson's ranch.
It was. I bought it from him.
So I was told in Largo. I don't get up this way very often. Doings in the county seat down on the railroad usually keep me occupied.
Sheriff, I'd be glad to tell you the whole story, but it'd please me if you'd lie down and come inside so we can talk in the house.
Marquez, did you and the Gallardo boys know that Señor Tillotson had sold his ranch?
No, Sheriff. Not until we rode up just a few minutes ago.
Well, Farnham and the other folks in Largo knew about it.
We do not shop at Señor Farnham's store. When we go to Largo, we stop at the cantina. And when we leave the cantina, we go back to El Rancho.
Fine, fine.
Lester tied the reins around the buggy's brake lever. When he climbed down from the buggy, his coat swung open enough for me to see the butt of a revolver in a cross-draw rig on his left side.
You boys can go on about your business now. You can come back later and talk to Senor Strickland about working for him, if he's still here.
Adios, Senor Strickland.
Adios, Santiago. But you too, Javier and Fernando. They rode off at a good clip, dust kicking up from their horses' hooves.
I suppose you can prove you bought the place from Tillotson?
I sure can. Come on in, I'll show you the bill of sale. I got coffee on the fire, too. We went into the ranch house, and I hung my hat on one peg near the door, and the Winchester on a couple of others close by. Since I was the only one living there, I didn't use the cook shack, but I did all my cooking in the fireplace instead. I had the coffee pot sitting on the hearth now, staying warm. I gestured toward it. Arbuckles?
Thanks.
I got a couple of cups from a shelf and poured. I handed Lester's cup to him. You know, Sheriff, you don't really sound much like a Texan.
I'm from Iowa.
I was born in Utah myself.
When did you buy this ranch from Abner Tillotson?
Back in December it was.
You say you have proof of that?
Yes, sir. I sure do. I went over to a little box I'd found and started using for important papers. I took out the bill of sale and the deed, which Abner would have given to me if we'd concluded our transaction the normal way. I handed them to Sheriff Lester to look at to his heart's content.
You should have gone to a lawyer and had a proper bill of sale drawn up and witnessed. This is worthless in a court of law.
Well, sir, I suggested as much to Abner, but he was in a bit of a hurry. He said that would stand up just fine, because everybody around here knows his signature.
Possibly. The sale should have been recorded with the county clerk, too.
Yeah, I just haven't had a chance yet to get down to the county seat and take care of that. Well, I plan on doing it, though, as soon as I can.
I wouldn't tarry if I was you.
Lester handed the papers back to me.
Where can I find Mr. Tillotson so I can check on all this with him?
Well, I don't rightly know. He didn't say where he was going when he pulled out.
Clyde Farnham says Tillotson was in poor health.
You know, I got the same feeling, but I didn't ask for details. I don't like to pry too much in a man's business.
I'd feel better about this whole affair if I could talk to Tillotson. For all I know, you murdered him and just moved in on the place.
By God, Sheriff, I don't care for what you're insinuating.
I'm not insinuating anything. I'm flat out saying it.
If you think I murdered Abner Tillotson, what you are is flat out wrong. I wouldn't have harmed a hair on that old man's head.
Good friends, were you?
No, but I liked him. And I wish we'd gotten to spend more time together. Now, I don't want to get too testy, Sheriff, but I've shown you the bill of sale and the deed. What more do you need to see?
Well, what if I take a look around the place and see if there's a grave a few months old?
Go ahead. You won't find any, because there ain't none. I was glad I'd changed my mind about putting up a marker for Abner up yonder on the hill. I decided it might be safer in the long run to let the grave go back to nature, and I didn't figure Abner would mind. To that end, I'd tamped the dirt down good, scattered some rocks around, and even transplanted a couple of cactuses over there, making it look like they'd been growing there all along. I didn't think the sheriff would spot anything different about the ground by now. For a minute, I thought the sheriff was going to take me up on my invitation to go ahead and search the place. Then he took another drink of coffee and set the cup on the table.
All right, but I'm going to look into this, Strickland. If I come out here to talk to you again, you'd better be here.
Sheriff, I'm not planning on going anywhere. Lester gave me a curt nod and started to turn away.
You know the Daughtry brothers?
Can't say as I do. They live around here.
They did. Folks in Largo said they hadn't seen him for several months, so I drove up to their place before I came here.
Well, I don't even know where it is.
About 4 miles northeast of here. Sorry little outfit on the edge of Fishhook Range. I've had it in my mind that the brothers, there were three of them, had been rustling some of Tillotson's stock.
I haven't lost any cattle.
I suppose not. The Daughtrys are gone. Looks like they abandoned the place. No horses, no cattle, and the shack was falling in. They'd left some personal things behind, but nothing to amount to anything.
No offense, Sheriff, but from the way you describe them, it's good riddance to those fellas, wherever they went.
I suspect most of the citizens in the county would agree with you, Strickland. Thanks for the coffee.
You're welcome. You come on back anytime you're of a mind to.
If I have a reason to be here, I will be.
With that, Sheriff Lester climbed up into the buggy and drove off. I wasn't sorry to see him go. Even when I haven't done anything wrong, me and Star Packers just don't mix. Since Sheriff Lester had told me about the Daughtry place being abandoned, I didn't think it would be too suspicious for me to ride over there and take a look around. As the new owner of the fishhook, I had a right to scout out the boundaries of my range, didn't I? So I saddled up and headed in that direction a day or two later. I wanted to make sure there was nothing there that the sheriff could trace back to me. It appeared that I owed a debt of gratitude to the buzzards, the coyotes, and the wolves. They dragged off and disposed of the remains, probably scattering the bones across the prairie. Sheriff Lester was right, though. The house looked like it had been abandoned. A gusty spring wind was blowing when I rode up. The door swung open on its leather hinges, one of which had partially rotted because of the exposure to the weather, making the door hang crooked. The wind blew it back and forth, but one corner dragged in the dirt. I thought about going inside to see if anything could be salvaged, but I didn't want to step in there. I didn't want anything that had belonged to the Daughtrys. I rode all around the shack, but I didn't see any bones anywhere. Satisfied, I turned and headed south toward the settlement. I needed a few things at the store.